Park Row Books and Harper Audio present Dear Wife, a novel by Kimberly Bell. Performed by Vivian Laney, Chris Andrew Shula, and Pete Simonelli. I hit my blinker and merge onto the Muskogee Turnpike, and for the first time in 7 long years, I take a breath. A real, full-body breath that blows up my lungs like a beach ball. So much breath that it burns. It tastes like freedom. 4 hours on the road, 283 miles of space between us, and it's nowhere near enough. I still hear the clink of your keys when you toss them on the table. Still tense at the thud of your shoes when you come closer to the kitchen. Still feel the fear slithering snake-like just under the surface of my skin. You have 3 moods lately. Offensive, enraged, or violent. That moment when you come around that corner and I see which one it is, always inches bile up my throat. It's the worst part of my day. I tell myself, no more. No more tiptoeing around your temper. No more dodging your blows. Those days, like Arkansas, are in my rearview mirror. For early afternoon on a Wednesday, the highway is busy. Dusty semis rumbling by on both sides. And I hold my hands at 10 and 2 and keep the tires between the lines. Oklahoma is crisscrossed with turnpikes like this one, 4-lane highways dotted with cameras for speeding and toll violations. It's too soon still for one of them to be clocking every black sedan with Arkansas plates that whizzes by, but I'm also not giving them any reason to. I use my blinkers and hold my speed well under the limit, even though what I'd really like to do is haul ass. I hit the button for the windows, letting the highway air wash away the smell of you, of home. At 64 miles an hour, the wind is brutal, hot and steamy and oppressive. It reeks of pasture and exhaust, of nature and chemicals, none of it pleasant. It whips up a whirlwind in the car, blowing my hair and my clothes and the map on the passenger seat, rocking it in the air like a paper plane. I reach down, shimmy out of a shoe, and smack it to the seat as a paperweight. You're serious about holding on to me, which means I need to hold on to that map. It may be old school, but at least a map can't be traced. Not that you'd have already discovered the number for the burner phone charging in the cup holder, but still. Better to not take any chances. I took the phone out of the package, but haven't powered it up. Not yet. Not until I get where I'm going. I haven't made it this far into my new life, only to be hauled back into the old one. So far, this state looks exactly like the one I left behind. Fields and farms and endless belts of faded asphalt. Sounds the same, too. Local radio stations offer one of 2 choices, country music or preachers. I listen to a deep voice glorifying the power of forgiveness. But it's a subject I can no longer get behind. I toggle up the dial, stopping on a Miranda Lambert anthem that's much more my speed these days, Gunpowder and Lead, and give a hard twist to the volume dial. For the record, I never wanted this. Running away, leaving everything and everyone behind. I try not to think about all the things I'll miss, all the faces I'll miss. Even if they won't miss mine. Part of the planning was putting some space between me and people I love most, not letting them in on the truth. It's the one thing I can't blame you for, the way I drove a wedge into those friendships all by myself, so you wouldn't go after them too. There's only one person who knows I'm gone, and everyone else. It'll be days, maybe weeks, until they wonder where I am. You're smart, so I have to be smarter. Cunning, so I have to be more cunning, not exactly a skill I possessed when we walked down the aisle all those years ago, when I was so squishy in love. I looked into those eyes of yours and promised till death would we part. And I meant every word. Divorce was never an option. Until it was. But the first time I mentioned the word, you shoved me to the floor, jammed a gun into my mouth, and dared me to say it again. Divorce. Divorce, 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 divorce. I never said the word out loud again, though I will admit it's been an awful lot on my mind. I picture you walking through the door at home, looking for me. I see you going from room to room, hollering and cursing, and finally calling my cell. I see you following its muffled rings into the kitchen, scowling when you realize they're coming from the cabinet under the sink. I see you wrenching open the doors and dumping out the trash and digging through sludgy coffee grounds and the remains of last night's stir fry until you find my old iPhone. And I smile. I smile so damn hard my cheeks try to tear in two. I wasn't always this vindictive. But you weren't always this mean. When we met, you were charming, warming up my car on cold mornings, or grilling up the most perfect strip steak for my birthday. You can still be sweet and charming when you want to be. You're like the cocaine they slip the dogs that patrol the cars at the border. You gave me just enough of what I craved to keep me searching for more. That's part of what took me so long to leave. The other part was the gun. So, no, I didn't want to do this. But I did plan for it. Oh, how I planned for this day. My first day of freedom.
Jeffrey. When I pull into the driveway after 4 days on the road, I spot three things all at once. First, the garbage bins are helter-skelter in front of the garage door 2 days after pickup, rather than where they belong, lined up neatly along the inside right wall. The living room curtains are drawn against the last of the afternoon light, which means they've probably been like that since last night, or maybe all the nights I've been gone. And despite the low-lying sun, the porch lights are on. Correction, one of them is on. The left side bulb is dead, its glass smoky and dark, making it seem like the people who live here couldn't be bothered with changing it. Which is inaccurate. Only one of us couldn't be bothered. And her name is Sabine. I stop. Shake it off. No more complaining. It's a promise I've made to myself. No more fighting. I grab my suitcase from the trunk and head inside. Sabine? I stand completely still, listening for sounds upstairs. A shower, a hairdryer, music or TV. But there's nothing. Only silence. I toss my keys on the table next to a pile of mail 3 inches thick. Sabine, you here? I head farther into the house. I think back to our phone conversation earlier this morning, trying to recall if she told me she'd be home late. Even on the best days, her schedule is a moving target, and Sabine doesn't always remember to update our shared calendar. She'd prattled on for 10 endless minutes about the open house she'd just held for her latest listing, some newly constructed monstrosity on the north side of town. She went on and on about the generous millwork and slate tile roof, the pocket doors and oak plank flooring, and a whole bunch of other features I couldn't give a crap about, because I was rushing through the Atlanta airport to make a tight connection, and it's quite possible that by then I wasn't really listening. Sabine's rambling is something I found adorable when we first started dating, but lately sparks an urge to chuck my phone into the Arkansas River, just to cut off one of her eternal run-on sentences. When I got to my gate and saw my plane was already boarding, I hung up. I peek out the window into the garage. Sabine's black Mercedes isn't there. Looks like I beat her home. I head into the kitchen, which is a disaster. A pile of dirty dishes crawling up the sink and onto the countertop. A week's worth of newspapers spread across the table like a card trick. Dead, drooping roses marinating in a vase of murky green water. Sabine knows how much I hate coming home to a dirty kitchen. I pick up this morning's cereal bowl, where the dregs of her breakfast have fused to the porcelain like nuclear waste, putrefied and solid. I fill it with water at the sink and fume. The trash bins, the kitchen, not leaving me a note telling me where she is. It's all punishment for something. Sabine's passive-aggressive way of telling me she's still pissed. I don't even remember what we were arguing about. Something trivial, probably. Like all the arguments seem to be these days. Crumbs on the couch, hairs in the drain. Who forgot to pick up the dry cleaning or drank the last of the orange juice? Stupid stuff. Shit that shouldn't matter. But in that hot quicksilver moment, somehow always does. I slide my cell phone from my pocket and scroll through our messages. Dispatches of a mundane married life. Did you remember to pay the light bill? The microwave is on the fritz again. I'm placing an order for office supplies. Need anything? I land on the last one to me, and bingo, it's the message I'm looking for. Showing tonight. Be home by 9. I spend the next half hour writing Sabine's mess. What doesn't go into the dishwasher, I pitch in the trash, then toss the bags into the garbage bins I line up. And then I haul my suitcase upstairs. The bed is unmade. Sabine's side of the closet, a pigsty. I try to ignore the chaos she left everywhere. Kicked off shoes and shirts with inside-out sleeves, shoved on lopsided hangers. Nothing like the neat, exacting lines on my side. How difficult is it to put things back where they belong? To line the clothes up by color? 10 minutes later, I'm in shorts and a t-shirt, sneakers pounding up the path in an angry sprint west along the river. The truth is, I am perfectly aware I am not the easiest person to live with. Sabine has told me more times than I'd care to admit. I can't help that I like things the way I like them. The car is washed, the house clean, dinner hot and waiting when I get home from work. Sabine is a great cook when she wants to be, when her job isn't sucking up most of her day, which lately seems like all the time. I can't remember the last night I came home to one of her home-cooked meals, the ones that take all day to prepare. Once upon a time, she would serve them to me in an apron and nothing else. I've spent a lot of hours thinking about how to bring us back to the way we used to be. Easy, sexy, surprising. Before my job dead-ended at a human resources company that sells buggy, overpriced software nobody wants to buy, before Sabine got her broker's license, which I used to laugh off as a hobby, now, on a good month, her salary is more than double mine. I tell her to quit, but honestly, we've gotten used to the money. It's like moving into a house with extra closet space. You always use it up. In our case, the money made us cocky, and we sank far too much of it into our house, a split-level eyesore with two tiny windows and crumbling siding. The inside was even worse. Cheap paneling and shaggy carpet on the floors, climbing the walls, creeping up the staircase. "You have got to be shitting me," I said, as she led me through the cramped, musty rooms. It looked like a 70s porn set. It looked like the destitute version of Hugh Hefner would be coming around the corner in his tattered bathrobe any second. No way were we going to live here. But then she took me to the back porch, and I got a load of the view. A sweeping panorama of the Arkansas River. She'd already done the math. A 30-year mortgage based on the estimated value after a head-to-toe renovation. An amount that made my eyes bulge. We bought it on the spot. So now, we're proud owners of a beautiful craftsman-style bungalow on the river. Even though as children of Pine Bluff, a working-class town wedged between farms and factories, we should have known better. The house is on the wrong side of town, a castle compared to the split-level shacks on either side of the street, and no renovation, no matter how extensive, could change the fact that there aren't many people in town who can afford to buy the thing. Not that we'll ever be able to sell. Our house doesn't just overlook the river, it is on the river, the ropey currents so close, they swell up the back steps every time there's a sudden rain. But the point is, Sabine's job, which began as a fun little way to provide some extra income, is now a necessity. My cell phone buzzes against my hip, and I slow to a stop on the trail. I check the screen, and my gut burns with irritation when I see it's not Sabine, but her sister. I pick up, my breath coming in sharp, sweat-humid puffs. "Hello, Ingrid." My greeting is cool and formal, because my relationship with Ingrid is cool and formal. All those things I admire about my wife, her golden chestnut hair, her thin thighs and tiny waist, the way her skin smells of vanilla and sugar, are glaring deficiencies in her twin. Ingrid is shorter, sturdier, less polished. The wallflower to Sabine's prom queen. The heifer to her blue ribbon cow. Ingrid has never resented Sabine for being the prettier sister, but she sure as hell blames the rest of us for noticing. "I'm trying to reach Sabine," Ingrid says, her Midwestern twang testy with hurry. "Have you talked to her today?" A speedboat roars by on the river, and I wait for it to pass. "I'm fine, Ingrid, thank you. And yes, though it was a quick conversation because I've been in Florida all week for a conference. I just got home, and she's got a showing. Have you tried her cell?" Ingrid makes a sound low in her throat, the kind of sound that comes right before an eye roll. "Of course I've tried her cell at least a million times. When's the last time you talked to her?" "About an hour ago." The lie's instant and automatic. Ingrid might already know that I hung up on her sister this morning, and she might not. But one thing is certain. She's not going to hear it from me. "Sabine said she'd be home by 9, so you might want to try her then. Either way, I'll make sure to tell her you called." And with that, I hit end, dial up the music on my headphones to deafening, and take off running into the setting sun.
Beth. The district at River Bend is an uninspired apartment community on the banks of Tulsa's Arkansas River, the kind that's generically appealing and instantly familiar. Tan stone, beige siding, indistinguishable buildings of 3 and 4 stories clustered around an amoeba-shaped pool. There are a million complexes like it in a million cities and towns across America, which is exactly why I chose this one. I pull into an empty spot by the main building, grab my bag, along with the clothes on my back, my only earthly possessions, and head to the door. People barely out of college are scattered around the massive indoor space, clutching paper coffee cups or ticking away on their MacBooks. Everybody ignores me, which is an unexpected but welcome development. I make a mental note that a complex like this one would be a good place to hide. In the land of self-absorbed millennials, anybody over 30 might as well be invisible. I spot a sign for the leasing office and head down the hallway. The woman perched behind the sleek glass desk is one of them. Young, blonde, pretty. The kind with a carefully curated Instagram feed of duck-face selfies and hand-on-hip glamour shots. I pause at the edge of her desk and she looks up with a blinding smile.
"Hi there. Are you looking for a home in the premier apartment community in Tulsa? Because if so, you've come to the right place."
Good Lord. Her Midwestern drawl, her Kardashian whine, her unnaturally white teeth. This girl can't be for real.
Right. So I was looking at the one-bedroom units on your website and... "Oh my gosh, then this is your lucky day. I literally just learned there's a Vogue unit available starting next week. How does 800 square feet and a balcony overlooking the pool sound?"
I hike my bag higher on a shoulder. "It sounds great, but I was hoping to find something that's available a little sooner."
"Like how much sooner?"
"Like immediately." Her collegiate smile falls off her face.
"Oh, well, I have a couple of one-bedroom units available now, but they're all smaller and they don't offer that same stunning view."
I shrug. "I'm okay with that." She motions to one of the upholstered chairs behind me.
Then have a seat and I'll see about getting you into one of our alpha units. When were you thinking of moving in?
I sink onto the chair, dragging my bag into my lap. Today, if possible. Her eyes go wide and she shakes her head.
It's not possible, I mean. The application process takes a good 24 hours, at least.
My heart gives an ominous thud. Application process? I know about the application process. I've already scoured the website and know exactly what it takes to get into this place. I also know that this is where things can get sticky. The woman nods.
I'll need 2 months' worth of pay stubs, either that or proof of salary on your bank statements, a government-issued ID like a driver's license or passport, and your social security number. The background check is pretty standard, but it takes a day or two, depending on what time of day I submit.
I have all the items she requested, right here in an envelope in my bag. But as soon as this woman plugs them into her computer, one little click of her mouse will propel all my information into the ether. Background checks mean paper trails, clues, visibility. Once you spot me in the system, and you will, I'll have only a few precious hours before you show up here looking for me. She checks the time on her cell.
If we hurry, I could get everything through the system by close of business tomorrow.
By then, I'll be long gone. I push the envelope across the desk.
Then let's hurry. I start my new job in 2 days, and I'd really like to be settled before then.
She flips through the packet of papers. Her fingers pause on my bank statement, and the air in the room thickens into a soupy sludge. Apartment complexes require a minimum salary of 3 times the rent, which is why I added a couple of zeros to that statement in lieu of proof of salary. Part of the preparations for day one included learning Photoshop. It's not the amount she's focused on, but my former address.
Arkansas, huh? So what brings you to town?
I relax in the chair.
I got a job at Quick Trip.
It's a lie, but judging by the way her face brightens, she buys it.
A friend of mine works there. She loves it. Great benefits. Way better than this place. Though if you ever repeat that, I'll deny ever saying it.
She grins like we're in on the same joke, and so do I. I gesture to the packet in her hand.
I don't have pay stubs yet, which is why I've included a copy of my contract.
Forged, but still, it looks real enough. As long as her friend doesn't work in human resources, nobody but me and the Pine Bluff Public Library printer will ever know it's a fake. I give her time to flip through the rest of the documents, which are real. My real driver's license, my real social security number, my real address. Scratch that. Former address. This entire plan rests on her accepting the papers in her hands, on me laying this decoy trail, then disappearing. She looks up with a wide smile.
It's not often that I get a prospective tenant with a record this spotless. Unless the system catches something I've missed, this is going to be a piece of cake.
I can't tell if her words are a question or a warning. I smile like I assume they're neither. She drops the papers on her desk and reaches for the mouse.
Let's get you in the system then, why don't we?
You and I met at a McDonald's, under the haze of deep-fried potatoes and a brain-splitting migraine. The headache is what lured me there, actually, what gave my body a desperate craving for a Happy Meal, a magical medicinal combination of starch and salt and fructose that works better than any pill I've ever poked down, the only thing that will loosen the vise clamping down on my skull and settle my churning stomach. But good. So there I sat in my sunglasses, nibbling French fries, while tiny monsters pounded nail after nail into my brain, when you leaned into the space between our tables
What did you get?
I didn't respond. Speaking was excruciating, and besides, I had no clue what you were talking about. You pointed to the box by my elbow.
Don't those things come with the toy? What is it?
I pushed my sunglasses onto my head and peered inside. It's a plastic yellow car. I pulled it out and showed it to you.
That's a Hot Wheels.
I settled it on the edge of my tray. A what?
Pretty sure that one's a Dodge Charger. Every boy on the planet has had a Hot Wheels at some point in their lives. My nephew has about a billion of them.
You were distractingly gorgeous. The kind of gorgeous that didn't belong in a fast food joint, chatting up a stranger about kids and their toys. Tall and dark and broad-boned, with thick lashes and a strong square chin. Italian, I remember thinking, or maybe Greek. Some long-lost relative with stubborn genes. I held the car across the aisle. Take it. Give it to your nephew. Your lips sneaked into a smile, and maybe it was the carbs finally hitting my bloodstream. But you aimed it at me that day, and the pain lifted just a little. 3 days later, I was in love. So now, when I push through the glass door to the restaurant, I am, of course, thinking of you. Different state, different McDonald's, but still. It feels fitting, almost poetic. You and I, ending in the same spot we began. The smell hits me. French fries and sizzling meat. And it prompts a wave of nausea. A faint throbbing somewhere deep in my skull, even though I haven't had a migraine in months. I guess it's true what they say, that scent is the greatest memory trigger. So I shouldn't be surprised that one whiff of McDonald's can summon the beginnings of a migraine. I swallow a preventative Excedrin with a bottle of water I purchase at the register. For a fast food restaurant at the mouth of a major interstate, the place is pretty deserted. I weave through the mostly empty tables, taking note of the customers scattered around the dining area. A mother flipping through a magazine while her kids pelt each other with chicken nuggets. A pimply teenager watching a YouTube video on his phone. An elderly couple slurping brown sludge up their straws. Not one of them looks up as I pass. I select a table by the window with a view of the parking lot. A row of pickup trucks glitter in the late afternoon sun, competing for most obnoxious. Supersized tires with spit-shined rims, roll bars and gun racks, wavy flag decals on the rear window, people of God, guns, and Trump, according to the bumper stickers. A common Midwestern stereotype that I found to be 100% true. Another stereotype. The lone woman in sunglasses, sitting at a fast food restaurant with no food, is up to no good. I consider buying a dollar meal as cover, but I'm too nervous to eat. I check my watch and try not to fidget. 3 minutes to 5. This Nick guy better not be late. He is a crucial part of my plan, and I don't have time to wait around. You'll be getting home from work in an hour. You'll walk through the door and expect to find me in the kitchen, waiting for you with dinner. With the endless fetching of newspapers and remote controls and beer, with sex. Though whether your desire will be fueled by passion or fury is always a toss-up. The thought makes me hot and twitchy, my muscles itching with an immediate, intense need to race to my car and flee. An hour from now, a couple hundred miles from here, you'll be looking for me. How will I know you? I asked Nick 2 days ago during our one and only phone call, made from the customer service phone at Walmart, after I lied and said my car battery was dead. Nick and I have never actually met. We've not exchanged photographs or even the most basic of physical descriptions. I didn't know he existed until a week ago. Nick laughed.
What do you suggest I do? Carry a rose between my teeth? Don't worry, he'll know me.
I cast a sneaky glance at the teenager, laughing at something on his screen. Surely not. When we spoke on the phone, Nick didn't seem nearly so oblivious. My gaze shifts to the elderly man offering the rest of his milkshake to his wife. Not him either. When Nick rolls up at 5:30, I blow out a relieved breath because he was right. I do know it's him. Because any other day at any other McDonald's, he's the type of guy I wouldn't have noticed at all. It begins with his car. A nondescript four-door, he squeezes between a souped-up Ford F-250 and an extended-bed Dodge Ram. His clothes are just as unexceptional. Generic khakis and a plain white shirt over mud-brown shoes. He looks like a math professor on his day off, or maybe an engineer. He walks to the door and his eyes, shaded under a navy baseball cap, don't even glance my way. He orders a cup of coffee at the counter, then carries it over to my table and sinks onto the chair across from me. Nick, I assume. From the look he gives me, there's no way Nick is his real name.
And you must be Beth.
Touché. Not my real name either. Up close, he's better looking than I thought he'd be. Wide-set eyes, angled chin, thick hair poking out the rim of his cap. In a normal world, in jeans and a rumpled t-shirt, Nick might not be half bad. He dumps 3 packets of artificial sweetener into his coffee and swirls it around with a red plastic straw.
It's the only way I can stomach this stuff, by masking it with something that tastes like it was imported straight from Chernobyl. If I grow an extra ear, I'm blaming you.
It's a little dig, because Nick here wanted to meet at the Dunkin' across the street. He wasn't the least bit subtle about it either.
If you don't mind, I'd really rather meet at the Dunkin', he said.
Not once, but enough times that the old me almost caved, even though I did mind. Because what I called Nick here to discuss has to be done in a McDonald's. The universe demands it. Symmetry demands it. This place has special memories for me, I tell him now. Not so much an apology as an explanation, an olive branch for the Chernobyl coffee. Not good memories, but memories nonetheless. Let's just say it's karma that we do this here. Nick shrugs, letting it go.
Karma's a bitch. Best not to piss her off, I always say.
He takes a sip of his coffee, then puts it down with a grimace, clasps his hands on the formica table, waits. I understand you travel extensively for business. Nick came highly recommended to me exactly because of this qualification. Must travel extensively for business. The other qualifications, must be dependable and discreet, were something I mentally checked off as soon as I clocked him walking through the door, on time, and in clothing that might as well make him invisible.
I'm on the road more often than not, yes.
Long trips?
It varies. Sometimes I need to stay put for a day or two, but even then I'm never sleeping in the same bed 2 nights in a row. I like to move around, just in case.
He leaves it at that, just in case. And I don't ask. Whatever he means by it, I honestly don't care to know. For the job I called him here to do, it makes 0 difference.
But sure, he continues, shrugging again. In a typical month, I'll log 3,000 to 4,000 miles, so I guess that qualifies as long trips.
Do you have a home base?
Multiple home bases. But like I said, I'm hardly ever there.
Perfect, he grins.
Tell that to the missus.
I'm pretty sure he's joking, or maybe he's saying it to try to throw me off his tail. Men like Nick aren't the marrying type, or if they do marry, it's more for convenience or cover than for love. Never for love. That's funny, I say, twisting the cap on my water. I always liked it when my husband traveled for work. As soon as I say the words, I want to swallow them back down. The skin around Nick's eyes tightens just for an instant, but long enough I catch it. Unlike his joke, harmless words about a wife that doesn't exist, mine revealed too much. That the husband is real. That life was better when he was gone. Nick is not my friend. He's not someone I should be joking with over a cup of crappy coffee. This is a business meeting, and the less he knows about me, the better. I slide a shiny Wells Fargo card from the side pocket of my bag and push it across the table. I want you to spend my money. He doesn't say anything, but he picks up the card, running a thumb over the shiny gold letters across the front. My real name, definitely not Beth. When he looks back up, his expression is unreadable. For the record, I don't mean spend it as in booking a first-class ticket to Vegas and going nuts at the roulette wheel, but spend it as in $10 here, $20 there. I want you to move around a lot. Never the same ATM or even the same city twice. The farther away the withdrawals are from each other, the more varied the locations, the better. Think of me as your ATM fairy godmother.
You want me to lay a trail?
I tip my head, a silent confirmation. Assuming you don't withdraw more than $100 a week, which you can't because I've set up the card with a weekly limit, you'll get 5 weeks of money off that card.
And my fee?
His fee is $500, an amount he made very clear on the phone is non-negotiable. Whatever it is I'm hiring him to do comes on top of that, which means this is a job that comes with a hefty cash bonus, one that's double his fee, probably the easiest money he's ever made. Your fee is on there, too. You can withdraw that today. The weekly limits kick in as soon as you do. He hikes up on a hip and slips the card into the front pocket of his pants.
You want me to go east or west?
I know why he's asking, because he assumes I'd want him to head in the opposite direction. Or at least I think that's why he's asking. But I'm still stinging for my slip-up, and thanks to the card in his pocket, Nick now knows my real name. No way I'm telling him, a criminal, a stranger, where I'm planning to land. Not that I think he'd come after me, but still, if there's one thing I've learned these past 10 years, it's to trust no one, not even the people you're supposed to trust the most. East, west, north, south, I don't care, as long as your withdrawals are erratic and your stops unpredictable. I'll be watching the transactions online, and if I don't like what I see, I'll put the brakes on the account.
You do know there are cameras at every ATM, right?
I roll my eyes. Of course I know. I didn't spend the past 10 months planning this thing to have not thought about something as basic as security cameras. But it'll be days, maybe even weeks before you find the withdrawals. Longer before you see Nick's face on the tapes instead of mine. I'm not worried about the stupid cameras. Make sure to smile, pretty. I pull my bag onto my shoulder, a sign that this conversation, an interview and marching orders at the same time, is over. The PIN is 2764. Nick reaches for his coffee cup, still full but no longer steaming, then thinks better of it. He leaves it on the table and stands.
I bet that happens a lot, doesn't it?
What does?
That people underestimate you. That they think you're greener than you actually are. And before you roll your eyes at me again, you should know that's not a bad thing. If things get hairy, you can use it to your advantage.
Now, finally, he gets a grin from me. I'm counting on it.
Jeffrey. I jerk awake on the couch, and the crystal tumbler bouncing on my stomach pitches over a hip. I roll away from the spill, shifting to one side, but I'm too late. The liquid has already seeped through my jeans, dripping a good 2 fingers of expensive bourbon down my leg and into the fabric of the cushion. With a groan, I plunk the glass on the floor, push myself upright, and try to get my bearings. The half-eaten pizza I ordered for dinner sits cold and congealed on the coffee table, and I flip the box closed. Images of a house fire flicker on the television on the wall, a handful of figures in slick yellow gear under a dripping arc of water. I reach for the remote and hit the button for the guide. Tiny numbers at the top of the screen tell me it's 11:17 p.m. Shit. When I stretched out on the couch, it was 8:45. The 4 days of travel, of being on all day at the conference, must have worn me out more than I thought. Sabine? No answer. But then again, she's probably sound asleep. I picture her upstairs in bed, her long hair like silk across the pillow, and a familiar fire burns in my chest. Why didn't she come in to say hi? Why didn't she wake me? I click off the TV and stand. The downstairs is quiet. The lights are still burning bright in the hallway. I flip them off on my way to the stairs, pausing at the doorway to the kitchen. The counter is still spotless, and the three matching pendants over the island light the air with a golden glow. Sabine might be a slob, but she hates wasting money as much as I do. If she were here, if she'd sneaked past me on her way upstairs, she would have turned off the lights. Unease tightens the skin of my chest. I jog across the kitchen tiles and yank open the door to the garage, getting a faint, heady whiff of gasoline. My car, right where I parked it. In Sabine's spot, nothing but an oil stain on the concrete. My heart gives a painful kick. I take the stairs by twos and threes, sprinting down the hallway runner and into the bedroom, even though I already know what I'll find. The comforter, still unturned from where I'd made it. The pillows, still stacked and fluffed. The bed, empty.
Beth. I stand at the bathroom sink of room 17 in a grubby motor lodge on the outskirts of Tulsa and take inventory in the mirror. Chalky skin, eyes shaded with purple circles, hair too long, too thick to style. You're always telling me never to cut my hair. You say you like it long. Dark, thick strands streaked with shiny ribbons of bronze, with just the right amount of curl. It's the kind of hair you see on commercials, the kind women pay hundreds of dollars a month for. But it's more than just hair to you. It's a plaything, a turn-on, something to plow your fingers through or moan your orgasms in whenever we have sex. But this hair you claim to love so much, you also love to use it as a weapon, to drag me by it from room to room. To pin me down. Hair is so much stronger than you think it'd be. The roots like barbed hooks in your skin. The scalp will rip open sooner than a hank of hair will break. I know this from experience. I pick up a handful and a pair of shears and slice it in an uneven, stubby line. It's a lot easier than I thought it would be. A hell of a lot less painful than when you grab me by the ponytail and lift me clear off the bed. The strands tumble down my chest, sticking to the white cotton of my shirt. I feel lighter, unencumbered, free. I keep chopping, brushing the strands into the sink to toss later, not because I think you'll track me here, but because I believe in karma. One day very soon I'll need a job. And it's not unthinkable I'll end up in a hotel room like this one, scrubbing someone else's hairs from the drain. Not exactly what my parents were hoping for when they paid for my college, but a better-paying job, a job I'm actually qualified for, would send up a smoke signal you might spot. I've never cut my own hair before, and I don't do a particularly good job of it. I was going for a pixie cut. But it's more of a walk-in salon hack job, or maybe a sloppy bowl cut from the 70s. I pick up random chunks, pull them between my fingers like a hairstylist would, and slice in asymmetrical layers. When I'm done, I fluff it with my fingers and study myself in the mirror. With a bit of hair gel, it might not be half bad. You are not who you used to be. You are Beth Murphy now. I'm Beth, I say, trying on the name like a questionable shade of lipstick. It's the name I gave Nick, the one I signed on the hotel register, but only after forking over $2.20 so the man behind the counter didn't ask for my ID again. My name's Beth Murphy. Beth with the crappy haircut. I dig the box of hair dye from the CVS bag and mix up the color. In my previous life, I was one of those brunettes who never longed to be a blonde. Blondes are louder, bolder, more conspicuous, flashy and competitive, like sorority girls and cheerleaders. Not good traits when your goal is to disappear. The picture on the box advertises an ashy blonde, the least in-your-face blonde of the blonder shades. Blonde for beginners. I paint it in lines across my scalp with a plastic bottle, then slip off the gloves and check my watch. 10 minutes until we find out if what they say is really true, that blondes have more fun. While I wait for the color to set, I flip on the television. It's past midnight, and I'm 300 miles away from Pine Bluff. Too late for a local broadcast, and too soon for news of my disappearance to have spread across state lines and made it to cable. Still, I sit on the edge of the bed and flip between CNN and Fox, watching for the tiniest sliver of my story. An empty house. A missing woman. My face hidden behind dark sunglasses, spotted heading west. But there's nothing. And I'm torn between relief and dread. You'll be looking for me by now. I shower and dress in the clothes I bought earlier at Walmart, a dowdy denim skirt and a shirt two sizes too big. The duffel on the bed is stuffed with clothes just like them, synthetic fabrics and Easter egg colors, cheap and outdated items I'd normally turn up my nose at. In my former life, I would have turned up my nose at Beth, too, with her baggy clothes and dollar store hair. Beth is a frump. I leave the key on the nightstand, gather up my things, and step outside. Sometime in the past few hours, clouds have rolled in, a dark and threatening blanket hanging over muggy, electrically charged air. The wind is still, but it won't be for long. I've lived in these parts long enough to know what a wall cloud looks like, and that they often swirl into tornadoes. A bolt of lightning rips the sky in two, clean as a knife slash. Time to either hunker down or get the hell out of Dodge. I choose door number two. My car is exactly where I left it, at the far edge of the lot next to the dumpster, though my is a relative term since the car doesn't officially belong to me. It belongs to a Marcia Ann Norwood of Little Rock, Arkansas, a woman who seemed as eager for a discreet, all-cash transaction as I was. I bought it 2 weeks ago, then moved it from lot to lot in a neighboring town, but I never transferred the title to my name. I peek inside, and things are exactly as I left them. The keys dropped in the cup holder, the title folded on the front seat, the doors unlocked. I cast a quick glance up the asphalt, taking in the other cars, jalopies like this one. My car is no prize, but it's an easy target, a jackpot for any wannabe thief. No, Marcia Ann's car won't be here for long. I turn, head to Dill's Auto Repairs and Sales across the road.
You can't buy a car,
you told me once when it was time for me to trade up.
Just keep your mouth shut and let me handle it.
Dill might disagree, seeing as I'm able to sweet-talk more than 10% off a 1996 Buick Regal. It's a rusty old pile of junk, but the motor runs, and the price is right, especially once I discover that Dill likes it when I call him Sugar. He forks over the paperwork and the address for the nearest Oklahoma DMV, which I promise to visit first thing in the morning. If I hurry, I'll be in the next state by the time the office doors open. He hands me the keys and I fall inside and crank the engine, right as the skies open up.
Jeffrey. The first number I call is Sabine's, even though I know before I dial the first digit it's a waste of time. If Sabine is pissed, if she's punishing me for something, she's not going to pick up. And if something's happened... My stomach twitches, and I push the thought aside. Her phone rings, 4 eternal beeps, then flips me to voicemail. Sabine, it's me. Did I forget you were going somewhere tonight? Because I got the message where you said you'd be home by 9, but now it's almost midnight and you're still not here. Call me back, will you? I'm at home, and I'm starting to get a little worried. Okay, bye. I hang up, think about calling 911, but she's what, less than 3 hours late? Not long enough to be an emergency. And don't the police require a minimum of 24 hours before you can report a person missing? What am I going to tell them? That my wife missed her curfew? I slip my cell in my pocket and pace the length of the upstairs hallway. Okay, so I know she had a showing. A late showing. Even if it ran over. Even if it were all the way on the other side of town and she decided to grab a bite to eat before coming home, she would have been here by now. And it's not like Sabine to ignore her phone. It's one of her least desirable job requirements that she's always, always available. From the moment she wakes up until the time she goes to sleep, there's a device either in her palm or pressed to one of her ears. If her car broke down on the way home, if she's sitting on the edge of the highway with a flat tire and no clue how to switch it for the spare, she would have called roadside assistance. And then she would have called me. Assuming she's conscious. My skin snaps tight at the thought of her bleeding on the side of the road, or worse, floating face down in the Arkansas River. I picture her bobbing in the currents or caught in the reeds that line our backyard. I see some sicko dragging her into the show house, her heels digging into the brand-new hardwood floor, screaming into the empty house. I've never loved the thought of her showing houses to complete strangers. It was one of the sticking points between us when she took this job, the idea that anyone could come by pretending to be a prospective client. What if a prisoner escaped from Randall Williams? What if he had a knife or a gun? She might as well put a sign out front and a target on her back. Pretty broker, here for the taking. I pull out my phone and call her again. Sabine, seriously, this isn't funny. Where are you? I get that you're still mad at me, but at least shoot me a text so I know you're breathing. I'm really worried here. I'm giving you one more hour, and then I'm calling the police. I hang up and haul in a deep, calming breath. But it doesn't help. Something's wrong. I don't know what it is yet. I just know that something is very, very wrong. I pull up the number for her sister. Ingrid picks up on the first ring, like she'd been lying there with her finger hovering above the screen, waiting for it to light up with a call. Her voice is gruff and insistent. Hello? Not a question. Said with an upward lilt at the end, like how a normal person answers the phone, but a demand. More grunt than word. How these two women share the same DNA is one of God's great mysteries. Ingrid, it's Jeffrey. Sorry to call you at this hour, but I have caller ID, Jeffrey. Put Sabine on the phone. I close my eyes and inhale, long and steady. That's the reason I'm calling you in the middle of the night. I don't know where she is. What do you mean you don't know where she is? She's not with you? She didn't come home after her showing, and she's not answering her phone. Jesus, Jeffrey, and you're just calling me now? What the hell have you been doing all this time? I hear a rustling of fabric, the high-pitched squeal of bed springs. Ingrid lives alone, in a condo a couple of miles from here. I'm sure because nobody else can stand to share a roof with her. Who else have you called? Nobody. You're the first. And already, I'm regretting it. Talking to Ingrid is like chewing on glass. You just know it's gonna be painful. Do you know the number for her boss? I say. She had that late showing tonight, so maybe Russ will know what's going on? Russ? Ingrid's voice is clipped with exasperation. Russ moved to Little Rock in December. You should try Lisa. Who? Lisa O'Brien, Sabine's boss?
She pauses for my reply, but I don't know what to say. Sabine has a new boss? Since when?
Oh my God, did the two of you even talk? This all happened months ago.
I huff a sigh into the phone, done pussyfooting around Ingrid's shitty attitude. Do you have Lisa's phone number or not?
Not.
A door slams. A car engine starts.
Call the police, Jeffrey. I'm on my way.
When early on in our relationship, Sabine told me she had a twin, I remember thinking how lucky she was, how lucky I was. Somewhere out there was a carbon copy of this woman, the yin to her lovely yang. The idea felt like a novelty. Two Sabines for the price of one. And then I met Ingrid, and the dislike was both instant and mutual. This was right around the time they buried their father, and their mom was starting to repeat the same tired stories often enough that the sisters noticed. In those first few weeks, I attributed Ingrid's testiness to grief, to worry. I gave her a pass. But Ingrid was accustomed to being the most important person in her sister's life, and she made it clear she wasn't about to hand over the reins. Ingrid was fiercely territorial, and she treated me like a phase, an unwelcome but temporary intruder in their codependent lives. I accused Ingrid of loving her sister too much, and she accused me of not loving Sabine enough. Sabine felt caught in the middle, and from then on out planned our lives so Ingrid and I were rarely in the same room. I become a master at avoiding the woman, driving on at the first sight of her car when I'm out running errands, ducking into the next room at parties when she walks through the door. I eye her now across the kitchen table, taking in her dust bunny hair and shiny rosacea-covered cheeks as she makes notes on a yellow pad of paper. Fat, black pen strokes scratching out the name of Sabine's firm, her height and hair color, the number for her cell. This woman looks nothing like my wife. She is the angry ogre version of Sabine, the kind that bathes in swamp water and gnaws on bones under a bridge. Her face is scored with pillow marks, angry purple lines in the shape of a cross. I sigh, wishing I was the one with the pen and paper, wishing there was something I could do. My legs bounce under the table. We are sitting here, waiting for the police to arrive, and I don't have any patience. I want somebody to go out there and find my wife. There's got to be an explanation, I say. Ingrid shushes me, actually flicks her fingers in my direction, and hisses, shh, never once looking up from her scribbles. Upside down, her handwriting looks just like Sabine's, big, messy loops. Answer me, will you? I said there's got to be an explanation for wherever Sabine is, where she went. I'm terrified something happened to her. Ingrid grunts, and the sound sparks like flint in my gut. What is that supposed to mean?
I didn't say anything.
Yes, you did. You grunted.
If you have something to say to me, just say it. Don't grunt at me from the other side of the table.
The words come out just as angry, just as venomous as I feel. It's the middle of the night. My wife is unaccounted for, and the sloppier version of Sabine is sitting across from me, looking to start a fight. I don't know what it is about these Stanfield sisters, but they sure know how to scratch and pluck at my nerves.
Jeffrey, I didn't say anything.
No, but you wanted to. So go for it. This is your big chance. Say what you wanted to say.
Fine. You want me to say it?
She slaps down the pen, pressing it under her fingers.
Where's Sabine?
I'm the one who called you, remember?
Why are you asking me?
Ingrid rolls her beady snake eyes.
Come on, Jeffrey. My sister and I talk every day. We tell each other everything.
This isn't exactly news. On a good day, Ingrid and Sabine will spend hours on the phone, discussing the minutiae of everything from the tacos they ate for lunch to their favorite brand of tampons. Last weekend, they killed an entire afternoon deliberating on the consistency of their mother's latest bowel movements, and whether changing her diet might slow down the dementia that's eating up her brain. I know they talk 10 times a day. Most of the time, I'm witness to it. Well, clearly she didn't tell you where she was going tonight. Or maybe she was unable to.
For a second, I don't understand. A fleeting moment of, she thinks something bad happened too. And then I go completely still. Ingrid thinks something bad happened, all right. But she also thinks I had something to do with it.
Careful. I say the word like an order, sharp and commanding.
If I didn't know better, I'd think you were accusing me of something.
Why? Do you feel guilty?
No.
Because I know about your fights. Sabine calls me after every one.
Of course she does. The two are always on the same page, always, always of the same mind. They use the other both as a sounding board and a tuning fork. As long as the other sister agrees, then their opinions are vindicated. Two like-minded twins can't be wrong. And then there's that weird twin telepathy Sabine and Ingrid share, that creepy ability to know what the other is about to say before they even say it. Last year for Christmas, they bought each other the exact same gift, a hideous beige purse in the shape of a takeout bag. The two of them squealed like they'd both won the lottery. I don't know how to compete with that.
So? All couples argue. Which you would know if you could ever hold on to a man long enough to be in a relationship. Wherever Sabine is tonight has nothing to do with our arguments.
She cocks an unplucked brow.
You didn't even know she had a new boss, and that happened ages ago. When is the last time the two of you actually talked? When is the last time you had sex? None of your fucking business, that's when. And don't you ever ask me that again. Not while you're in my house.
She folds her hands atop the pad of paper, and I think she was calm if it weren't for her paper white knuckles.
Really? Because I'm pretty sure this house belongs to Sabine.
It's the most hateful thing she could say to me, and as much as I hate her for it, the person I really blame for her words is Sabine. Sabine knows the name listed on the mortgage is like the drunk relative trying to talk politics at a dinner party. Better just to ignore. It's always been a touchy subject between us. But, like Ingrid said, Sabine tells her sister everything.
My wife needs to keep her mouth shut. Our personal business is just that, personal. Sabine shouldn't be sharing every little thing that happens with you, just like I shouldn't have to tell you that wherever she is right now, I had nothing to do with it.
Ingrid goes silent, and I can tell she has more to say. She stares at me, chewing her lip, weighing her options. I see the exact instant the decision is made. Her eyes, Sabine's eyes, ice over.
She told me what you did to her.
She says it just like that, her voice low and deceptively calm, like I'll know what she's talking about. I do know, and the fury that rises in me is as familiar as the woman sitting across the table. Sabine told Ingrid what I did, and I want to leap across the table, wrap my fingers around Ingrid's throat, and squeeze until she wipes those awful, horrible words from her brain.
Did Sabine tell you what she did? I already told you. Sabine tells me everything.
Then you know that she pushed me first.
That's not an excuse. A man should never lay his hands on a woman, Jeffrey. I shouldn't have to tell you this.
Ingrid's condescending tone burrows under my skin like a tick. Sabine told me I was forgiven. She promised we would never speak of it again, and then she went blabbing it to her sister. Of course, Ingrid thinks the worst of me now. She only heard one side of the story. Sabine accused me of checking out of our marriage. She said I was emotionally and physically disengaged.
She kept harping on about her love tank being empty, whatever the hell that means. You know what? I shouldn't have to explain myself to you. The point is, we had a fight. It was bad. We both apologized, and we moved on. That's what successful couples do. They forgive each other and move on.
I hear the words coming out of my mouth, and I wonder if they're true. Not the part about Sabine's complaints. She's never been shy about voicing those. But the part about us as a couple. Forgiving each other. Being successful. Are Sabine and I a successful couple? Once upon a time,
we were. For the first few years, we were that couple, the one every other couple wanted to be. Happy, in love and in lust, both of them at the same time. The kind of couple that shoulders major life disappointments together. Her mother's sudden forgetfulness, my low sperm count, and their decided lack of mobility to reach Sabine's wonky uterus. We will get the very best care for your mother, I would murmur to a sobbing Sabine. We'll adopt. That was back when everything, even the most impossible, felt possible. I was a champion, a supportive husband, a fixer. I could fix everything. And then something happened that I couldn't fix. My career stalled out halfway up the ladder at PDK Workforce Solutions. Account executive may sound impressive, but it's a mid-level slog that entails sucking up to needy, curmudgeonly customers so they'll buy crap they don't actually need. But even more limiting, there's nowhere for me to go. The next rung is my boss's job, and he's blocking the ladder like a King of the Hill linebacker, with no plans to retire, change industries, or move to Toledo. I've put out some feelers, even talked to a couple of headhunters, but the only companies hiring are all the way in Little Rock, and Sabine wouldn't hear him moving. So yes, I may be bitter, but I'm not oblivious. I am fully aware how unfair it is to blame Sabine. But her success makes it so easy. I'm 40 and washed up, and she's just getting started. I come home beaten and burning with rejection to find Sabine glowing with the high of yet another sale. Lately, I've begun eating dinner alone in the den, mostly because I can't stomach her hum of satisfaction. And so, late last year, after a particularly shitty day at work, when I got home and Sabine wouldn't stop nagging, when she kept picking at every little flaw, when she accused me of checking out of our marriage, of sitting back and letting her do all the hard hitting for our house, our bank account, our sex life, her words filled me with a pure, inarticulate rage. She shoved me, and I hit her. I didn't plan to. I didn't mean to. It just happened. I know how this looks, believe me. I lost my temper with my wife, and now she's gone. Maybe she's trying to punish me for what I did. Or maybe my earlier hunch is right. Maybe something is really, really wrong. Either way, you don't have to tell me. I am the husband with a history of violence. The man living for free in the house his wife owns. The person with the most to lose or to gain. This doesn't look good for me.
Beth. The storm blows north, so I point the Buick south, aiming the nose toward Dallas. It's not the most efficient way to get to the East Coast, but I'm not in any sort of hurry, and it's an easy roundabout route that circumvents my home state of Arkansas entirely, even though you are hours, hopefully days, behind me. Even though you'll be on the lookout for a brunette in Marcia Ann's black sedan, not a blonde in a gas-guzzling Regal, already down to a quarter tank. Now is not the time to take any chances. I flip off the air conditioning and roll down the windows, letting in the humid highway air. One advantage of this stupid new hair, it doesn't blow into my eyes while I drive. My eyelids are dangerously heavy, and I stop often to grab another coffee and some snacks, to splash cold water on my face, to load up on gas, and an IHOP breakfast platter. Eggs, biscuits, sausage, the works. It's not my normal kind of meal. You like me thin and waif-like. But ever since leaving Pine Bluff, I've been ravenous. Maybe it's the relief of finally breaking free. Or maybe it's that I'm no longer my normal self. I'm Beth now, and Beth eats whatever the hell she wants. I'm nearing Atlanta when the sun comes up, streaking the sky with a spectacular orange and pink, so psychedelic bright that I reach for my sunglasses. My heart skitters in anticipation of my final, for now, destination, a city I visited for the first and only time with you ages ago, for a college buddy's booze-fueled wedding. The reception was loud and rowdy, and at the rotating restaurant atop the Westin downtown, where you twirled me around the dance floor until we were dizzy. Me from the shifting skyline, you from the cheap Russian vodka. When we stumbled downstairs to our room, I asked if you were drunk, and your answer was to shove me into a wall. Atlanta was the first time you hurt me that way, and the last place you'll think to look for me now. I know I'm close when a giant Delta jet lumbers over my head, its belly white and shiny, its wheels braced for landing. I catch a whiff of jet fuel, brace for the roar of its engines, a sound somewhere between an explosion and a NASCAR race. It rattles the steering wheel, the windows of my car, my teeth. All around me, people slam their brakes and traffic grinds to a halt. 6 lanes of bumper-to-bumper traffic, red tail lights as far as I can see. I study the map so I know where I'm going. Merge onto the downtown connector, follow it to I-20 East, then take a left on Boulevard to Cabbage Town. Eclectic and edgy is how the internet describes the East Atlanta neighborhood. But what sold me on it is its affordability, especially the Wiley Street Lodge, where one can rent a small but fully furnished room for a whopping $22 a night. I'll have to share a bathroom and kitchen, but still, I've already prepaid for the first week. An eternity later, I pull to a stop on Wiley Street and climb out. The road under me might as well be on fire, a steaming, sizzling furnace melting my tires and the soles of my sneakers. But it's the house I'm looking at, my stomach sinking at the sight. The yard is a foul-looking patch of dirt and scraggly branches that has seen neither fertilizer.